This is David Weiss for the Daily Worker Placement, and you're listening to The Game Changers, Episode 7, Deck the Halls, Part 2. In Part 1, we learn the story of how Donald X. Vaccarino, a neophyte designer, invented the genre of deck-building games with Dominion. In Part 2, we'll take a whirlwind tour through the games and designers that it influenced. We should start by defining what exactly makes a game a deck builder. BGG's official definition is, quote, "Players play cards out of individual decks, seeking to acquire new cards and to play through their decks iteratively, improving them over time through card acquisition," unquote. While there's nothing in that definition I disagree with, I feel it's a little too broad. By that definition, both Gloomhaven and Mage Knight, for example, are deck builders, and that just doesn't sit right with me. They're both amazing games, don't get me wrong, but they don't feel like Dominion to me. I think the difference is that in any game of Dominion, you're going to go through your deck 10 or more times, constantly adding and trashing cards, whereas in Gloomhaven, you pass through your deck exactly once per scenario, and alter your deck only when you level up. And in Mage Knight, you pass through your deck only once every round, 6 times during a whole game. And again, only adding or changing a few cards. It's like saying glaciers are rivers that move really slowly. It's true, but it's not all that helpful. So while Mage Knight and Gloomhaven might technically be called deck builders, I believe their delta, rate of change, is so small that they are qualitatively different beasts altogether. This also isn't going to be a complete list of deck builders, although I'd like to think I'll be covering all the big ones and or critical darlings. Also, I'm not going to review each one or even go into much detail about them. You can go to BGG for that. My intent here is to look for overall trends and interesting twists. Finally, as is probably obvious already, and definitely will be by the end of this episode, I'm a bit besotted with deck building. It just clicks for me. I know it's not everyone's thing, but even any haters out there have to acknowledge that deck building has become a standard mechanic alongside area control or role selection. 2 of the top 10 and 11 of the top 100 games on BGG are classified as deck builders. So let's start with Dominion's earliest and arguably most successful descendants. The first is Mike Elliott's Thunderstone, whose first edition came out in 2009. Being the first, it was also the most Dominion-like, with an A, B, C, D gameplay loop, a central market, and winning conditions based on the VPs in your deck. However, because of its fantasy dungeon delving theme, there were also a lot of new wrinkles. First, in an uncanny echo of Vaccarino's discarded Spirit Warrior design, which led to the creation of Dominion, players could level up their genetic starting heroes into specific classes with different abilities. Next was combat, with monsters emerging from a dungeon deck through 3 levels before emerging blinking into the daylight to ravage the local town. You could only fight monsters on lower levels if you could produce enough light with the cards in your hand, whether via lanterns or spells or innate class abilities. Killing some monsters had negative side effects, and while most monsters, once you killed them, sat there in your deck like Dominion's base game victory point cards, some had abilities you could trigger, as if you had tamed or absorbed their powers. Finally, there were 2 different types of attack damage in the game, physical and magic, and some monsters were less vulnerable or invulnerable to one or the other type. Thunderstone had a lot going for it, and its many expansions and sequels bear witness to its continued popularity. It's gone through 2 major revisions, rendering previous versions basically obsolete, which turned off fans like myself, but that hasn't stopped Elliott from continuing to tinker with it, adding semi- and fully cooperative and campaign-style modes. The year after Thunderstone was published saw the next major deck-building dynasty, Ascension, Chronicle of the Godslayer, now called just Ascension. It was published by Stoneblade Games and designed by Justin Gary, a former Magic the Gathering Pro Tour player. His stated purpose was to create a hybrid of Dominion and Magic, bringing a CCG-like experience to those who couldn't or didn't want to spend money on booster packs. In Ascension, there are also two types of currency, skill and fight, which are used to acquire cards. Instead of a central market, Ascension uses the conveyor belt approach that Vaccarino had considered and discarded for Dominion. Unlike Thunderstone, slaying creatures usually did not become part of players' decks. They were sent to a separate discard pile, and instead, when you killed them, you generated honor points, which the player drew from a common pool. When the pool ran out, the end of the game was triggered. Players also earned honor from cards acquired from the central row during the game. The biggest innovations in the original Ascension set, though, were factions and artifacts. Every non-creature belonged to one of four factions, each with its own set of synergies. Here's where the Magic the Gathering influence creeps in. Some faction cards were artifacts, which were not discarded at the end of your turn, but instead hung around until destroyed by opposing players' abilities. While played, artifacts had pretty good to awesome abilities, particularly if you acquired a lot of them from the same faction. Plus, they were worth a lot of points in and of themselves. Ascension has had dozens of expansions and promo card sets, all fully compatible with each other and all adding to the tactics and strategies players can use in the game. It's also one of the best ported to tablet games around, which is how I fell in love with it. My one and only face-to-face play of Ascension was right after it came out, and it left me feeling kind of meh. There seemed to be a lot of luck of the draw in terms of which cards became available in the center row on your turn, especially at higher player counts. But when Stoneblade released the digital version and the expansions began rolling out regularly, I came to joyfully anticipate each new addition to the game. The possibility of putting together unbelievable combos without having to worry about subjecting a human opponent to humiliation and boredom was truly intoxicating. I once managed to amass a final score of over 10,000 points, most of it earned on my final turn. The next deck builder dynasty came from a somewhat unlikely publisher, the Upper Deck Company. Well, actually their subsidiary, Upper Deck Entertainment. Founded in 1988, the Upper Deck Company made its name in sports trading cards, first pro baseball, then the National Hockey League and National Football League. They pioneered the concept of premium cards, using holograms and other devices to protect against card counterfeiting, and not incidentally, boost the asking price. In 2002, Upper Deck bought the rights to distribute Yu-Gi-Oh!, and later in the decade, the Upper Deck Entertainment Division was spun off to produce a World of Warcraft trading card game, the VS system of PvP superhero combat, and others. They then recruited Devin Lowe, who had worked on the Magic the Gathering 2010 core set, to design a new Marvel-themed deck-building game, and the result was, wait for it, Legendary. Well, Legendary, a Marvel deck-building game. Legendary is semi-cooperative, in that players have to work together to defeat a mastermind and his or her nefarious scheme. But the player who bops the most villains and minions and rescues the most bystanders is the winningest superhero. Like Ascension, Legendary uses faction-based cards to generate synergies. But any player can acquire cards belonging to any hero, which feels weird thematically at first because it means you're not playing an individual hero per se, but instead you're assembling team combos which trigger on your turn. Legendary has two central rows, one for the heroes emerging from the helicarrier, and one for the villains emerging from the sewers and then rampaging their way through the nameless city. Villains making it out of the city without being killed can trigger really bad consequences. Legendary's real plus is its replayability. The base set came with four masterminds who could each be paired with any of six schemes, which made for 24 different experiences right out of the box. And that doesn't even take into account the various hero and minion cards you had to choose from to populate those respective decks. Fans ate it up, including me, and the expansions soon came rolling out. But Upper Deck wasn't done. They realized the Legendary system could be adapted to entirely different situations, with, of course, entirely new fan bases to lure into its maw. So in the 2010s, we've seen Legendary games set in the worlds of the Alien Predator movies, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The X-Files, James Bond, and Firefly. Upper Deck was not the only publisher of superhero deck builders, though. In 2012, Cryptozoic Games introduced a DC hero-themed game using its patented Cerberus engine, which was actually a thinly disguised version of Ascension's mechanics. They've gone on to expand the DC universe via a slew of expansions and reboots, as well as adapting the system to such IP as the Penny Arcade webcomic, The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings trilogy, Teen Titans Go, the Attack on Titan anime, and Rick and Morty. In fact, except for a tiny minority of games such as Spyfall and Martin Wallace's The Arrival, the entire Cryptozoic catalog, deck builders and all, are themed around well-known intellectual property, or IP, a business model which we'll be discussing in a later episode. And latest, but certainly not least of the deck builder dynasties, we have White Wizard's Star Realms, which released in 2014. Designed by Darwin Castle, a member of Magic the Gathering's Pro Tour Hall of Fame, and Robert Doherty, who had worked on Ascension, Star Realms resembles Ascension with its conveyor belt central row and its faction-based cards. Unlike Ascension, the goal here is to reduce your opponent's authority, i.e. hit points, down to zero. Star Realms is noted for its many modes of play. You can play head-to-head, you can play many versus one, or even completely cooperatively. Like Ascension, it also has an excellent digital port, which includes many of its expansions, as well as a unique series of single-player campaigns made up of increasingly challenging scenarios, each of which monkeys with the game's start conditions or rules. Castle ported his system into two standalone sequels, Cthulhu Realms, which adds Lovecraftian elements such as sanity, and Hero Realms, which is set in your generic fantasy realm, and which introduced class-based starter decks and items, as well as campaign-style play. So that covers five of the deck-building dynasties that arose in Dominion's wake, but that hardly covers the extent of Dominion's influence. Over the past dozen years, deck building has been used to spice up everything from chess in For the Crown to word games in paperback and hardback, sports in games like Baseball Highlights 2045, war games like Undaunted Normandy, and ports of video games such as the super hot card game. Some of the designs tinkered with the formula only a little, others a little more. Two games forced players to challenge a convention which seemed baked into the deck-building formula, that smaller or thinner decks were more powerful than bigger decks. This is because smaller decks allow you to cycle through your cards more often, giving you more bang for your buck. There was a card in the Dominion base set which allowed you to trash up to four cards in your hand. It was called the Chapel. I remember the first time someone used the chapeling strategy on me on Brettspielwelt, the online portal where I played over 1,000 games of Dominion back in the day. Up until that point, I'd only ever bought chapels if witches were in the market, because that was one of the only ways to get rid of those -1 VP curse cards that witches blessed you with. In this game, there were chapels, but no witches available. And when my opponent bought a chapel on his first turn, I thought I was playing a noob. Then, on his third and fourth turns, they started chapeling the coppers and even estates from their starting decks. I typed into the chat box something like, did you mean to do that? And they typed back two words. Just watch. What happened next is that, having bought silvers with their following two buys, their deck was now only five cards, but two of them were silvers and the rest were coppers, and then the chapel, which meant they were drawing 5+ coins per turn, allowing them to start buying golds and better cards much sooner than usual. Within 5 turns, they were buying a province every round, and the game didn't last much longer than that. And that was my introduction to the chapeling strategy. Although later expansions introduced cards which made the chapeling strategy riskier, chapeling your deck soon became de rigueur, not only in Dominion, but also most other deck-building games. That is, until games like Valley of the Kings and Xenon Profiteer introduced mechanics which introduced more of a cost-benefit structure. In Valley of the Kings, an ancient Egypt-themed game, you only scored VPs for cards you chapeled or entombed, in the language of the game. But the cards which brought you the most VP also had amazing powers in-game, so you wanted to keep them in your deck for as long as possible. Timing became everything. Meanwhile, the space chemistry-themed Xenon Profiteer required players to continually buy low-cost basic element cards in order to fuse them into higher-valued inert gases from which the game got its name. I loved how I had to fight my acquired habits when I played these games. Other designers reintroduced a board, using deck building to revisit and revitalize genres like train games in 2012's Trains by Hisashi Hayashi, who we'll revisit later in this series. There was also dungeon delving in 2016's Clank, with its own expansions and sequels, and also good old racing games with 2017's Quest for El Dorado by none other than tabletop grandmaster Rainer Knizia. Deck building also spawned its own subgenre of card crafting in 2016's Mystic Veil by John D. Clare, which deconstructed the very nature of the cards themselves by having players buy not cards but clear plastic overlays which, when sleeved together, became single more powerful cards. Clare continued to explore card crafting on its own with games like 2017's Custom Heroes. Some designers realized that decks of cards were not the only vehicles for deck-building mechanics. Canada's own Eric Lang helped pioneer the dice-building genre with games like Quarriors and the Dice Master series, as well as other designers with games like Rattlebones and Dice Forge, which took things a step further by making the dice themselves customizable and constructible. Rainer Stockhausen's 2014 medieval-themed game Orléans popularized the bag-building genre, with tokens taking the place of cards in a worker placement-type environment. And Wilhelm Warsch won the Kennerspiel des Jahres in 2018 with his push-your-luck bag builder, the Quacks of Quedlinburg, with players taking the role of potion brewers, using tokens as ingredients to try and make the highest quality concoctions. Deck-building tropes also turned up heavily disguised in Marc-André's 2014 masterful gateway game Splendor, Emerson Matsushi's Century Trilogy, and Friedman Friese's solitaire game Friday. Friese is a deconstructor who loves the meta of game design. With his epic 504 game system, Friese produced a kind of design sandbox, with players choosing from menus of different mechanics to produce one-off, themeless games. And in 2012's Copycat, Friese consciously attempted to create a game which combined deck building, worker placement, and card drafting. He wasn't the only one who tried to embed deck building in a larger context. One of them was Martin Wallace, one of Britain's top designers, though he now lives in Australia. He began his career in the early 1990s, and by the later 2000s had designed several very popular titles, such as the railroad game Age of Steam, and the most highly rated economic game on Board Game Geek, Brass, currently at number 3 in its latest edition. In 2011, under his own publishing company Tree Frog, he released A Few Acres of Snow, about the 7 Years' War in North America, which Americans know as the French and Indian War. A Few Acres of Snow used deck building in a war game context with players maneuvering around the eastern seaboard of North America vying for control. To Wallace, deck building provided an excellent way of simulating both the uncertainty of command and control in warfare and the delay between requests for additional support and troops from the home country and their arrival from Europe. It was, in my opinion, a pioneering design, but after its release, some players found a fundamental flaw whereby the British could storm down the St. Lawrence and grab Quebec without the French being able to do much about it. This strategy was dubbed the Halifax Hammer, and controversy raged on about A, whether it indeed broke the game, and B, if so, what to do about it. In the end, Wallace made some minor adjustments in a second printing, but the damage had been done, and the game's reputation and sales took a major hit. Another newer designer who has found innovative ways to integrate deck building into his games is Alexander Pfister, with games like The Great Western Trail and Blackout Hong Kong. These games are definitely not for beginners, because they have many moving parts, of which the deck building is just one. But perhaps the biggest indication of deck building's influence comes from its penetration of the video game market. 2017 Slaying the Spire is perhaps the most popular and well-known example of this, but as of the time of writing, there are 150 games on Steam alone that have a deck building tag, and dozens of excellent iOS deck builders. I should know, I keep them in a separate folder on my iPad. More than worker placement, more than area control, more than any other tabletop mechanic, deck building has been embraced by video gamers. So, when it all comes down to it, what is the basis of deck building's appeal? You'll remember back in episode 2, I talked about how Magic the Gathering is really two games in one. There's the puzzle-like game of assembling your deck to suit your playstyle within the parameters of the cards you have, and then there's the actual duel of the Planeswalkers where you battle it out. The reason Dominion is undoubtedly a game-changer is that it was the first game that took the first part, deck building, and made it into a totally satisfying tabletop experience in and of itself. And not incidentally, it gave players a CCG-like experience without the uncertainty and expense of things like booster packs. Once Dominion appeared, it felt to me, as I'm sure it felt to many others, that it had been around forever. It was a natural idea that simply had to exist. Only, it was actually the product of one person's insight and hard work. By the end of the 2000s, tabletop was poised to make the next quantum leap in popularity. And in our next two episodes, we will look at the two games that made board games visible and hip at a level not seen maybe since the Monopoly craze of the 1950s. But before I sign off, since we're coming to the end of the first half of this series, I'd like to do something I haven't done before, which is to make a pitch to you to become one of our Patreon supporters. If you've been enjoying the Game Changers, along with all the other fine writing on the Daily Worker Placement, would you consider supporting us? We are, as far as I'm concerned, the best Canadian website when it comes to writing and talking about the tabletop world. The craft of writing and putting together this podcast takes a lot of time, and we do it out of love for the hobby. But speaking as the managing editor of the site, I would love to be able to offer our writers, and myself, to be honest, more than just exposure in return for our efforts. Okay, I'm done. Wow. That felt a lot like watching those pledge breaks on Channel 17 public television with Dave and Goldie that I grew up with, but from the other side, weird. Anyway, that was part 2 of episode 7 of The Game Changers. I'm David Weiss for the Daily Worker Placement. Thanks for listening. See you next time, and don't flip that table.